and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Linda Fleshinsky, a mother, grandmother, freelance writer, and former Racine School Board president. And now, here's today's host.
Good day and welcome to WGTD and this, our Saturday morning program, Community Matters. I'm Linda Fleshinsky, the host for this week's edition of Community Matters. Sometimes we look back at American history and how our country evolved over these many years, yet in our education about our nation, there's often very little attention paid to the history of Native Americans who were here in this land long before Europeans and other settlers began arriving. And so it's exciting for me today to have a guest who is Native American and who is in our area giving presentations to various groups on many aspects of Native American history. I think our listeners will be surprised by much of what you hear and learn in this hour. Joining us today is Heather Beagle of Northville, Michigan. She has a BA in history with a minor in political science and a master's degree in history. She has much teaching experience and awards and scholarship for her work. Joining us also in this discussion is Diane Lang, who many of you know for her great community work and public service as a Racine County board member for many years. Diane is largely responsible for getting Heather to be with us today. So with that, I just welcome both of you into our studio and thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So Heather, I'll start with you, and actually you'll be answering most of the questions, although Diane's going to be giving us some input too. But I just wondered, could you let our listeners know what it was that led you to be so interested in Native American history, which of course you're Native American, but did you know from little on that you would always, this would be a subject that you would want to pursue, or what led you?
No, I did not know that this was going to be, that specifically Native American history was going to be something that I was going to pursue. I actually have a very odd obsession with Thomas Jefferson. It's unhealthy, almost to the point where if he was alive, I feel like I would be his groupie. But so I was going to focus on early U.S. history, the founding, because that's all kind of really interesting to me. It wasn't until I, got older, went to Wounded Knee, South Dakota in 2016, as I was just finishing up my master's, because it was getting to the point where I was like, what am I going to do with this degree? Nobody's hiring any teachers of any kind. And it was at Wounded Knee that I realized that I was going to tell the story of our people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew I was Native American when I was growing up, but we talked about it, but it wasn't, like, stressed a lot. So I didn't really have a really strong understanding on my own heritage, but it was after Wounded Knee that I was like, this is what I'm going to do.
And in some talk, I think it was, that you said that going to Wounded Knee for you was like, became like a spiritual experience.
It was. I think I actually said that today too again. It was really very much a spiritual experience. When you are standing on that sacred ground and you look around you and you just envision what happened at Wounded Knee in 1890, and the breeze is blowing and the grass is as tall as you are and it's swaying, you can hear the ancestors. You can hear the voices.
Yes. So, yeah. And, if you say to most people Wounded Knee, they know that it was a massacre. They know it was a horrible event. But I wonder if you could give our listeners just a little background on what happened at Wounded Knee.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the winter of 1890, the U.S. government got word of something called the Ghost Dance. And the Ghost Dance was a spiritual dance that is part of Native American religion, just like the Sun Dance would be. But this particular dance was done by the Lakota, which are out in that area. And they did it because they believed that if they did this ghost dance and they spoke to the Great Spirit or the Creator, that if they offered up, themselves and spiritual blessings, that things would go back to the way they were, meaning the settlers would get out, mm-hmm. and they would be able to live in harmony again, and things would be as they were before settlement encroached. And so that was deemed as a threat to the United States government. And so they outlawed the ghost dance. And actually, the ghost dance was outlawed all the way until the 1970s.
No
when
kidding.
We could, huh. yeah, when the, we, yeah, most Native American religion was outlawed until the 1970s. But that's a whole other story. but, and so what happened is Sitting Bull was a ghost dancer. And, well, it was rumored that he was a ghost dancer. And so they went to arrest him where he was, and he ended up being killed instead. And so word spread throughout Lakota country. And Chief Spotted Elk started to lead his people to what is now the Pine Ridge Reservation, which was under the protection of Chief Red Cloud. And Red Cloud was like, yes, come to us, we'll protect you. And so as they're making their way, they're stopped by the 7th Cavalry, the U.S. 7th Cavalry. Which should sound familiar if you think about the Battle of Little Bighorn.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were forced to make camp in the middle of winter. The cavalry went around and unarmed all of the Lakota, which that particular group was elderly men, women, and children. And what happened the next morning is as they were trying to unarm all these Lakota, one of the Lakota, who he was deaf, and he was trying to explain that his gun was really important to him. He spent a lot of money on it, and it accidentally fired. And so then shots just rang out everywhere. And at the end, you're left with around 300 unarmed Lakota being massacred.
200 women and children.
Yeah.
Died there.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting what I heard you say in your talk, that 20 medals were given to the U.S. military who killed 300 unarmed people, and there still is was that ever revoked?
No. Mm-hmm. No, those medals are still hanging up. The U.S., I mean, anyone in military service knows you're awarded a Medal of Honor when you do something that's, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's an honor to get a Medal of Honor, and I totally think that's awesome and that's brilliant, but they awarded 20 Medals of Honor for massacring unarmed people.
And that's still protested against
it is,
by
yes.
Native Americans.
Yes.
You know, when you look at history, it must be a little painful for you. I think about that, about African Americans who look back who had ancestors who were slaves, too. Could you tell our listeners a little about the indigenous population? I think you said it was 12 million when the settlers started coming. And what has happened to those numbers and Native Americans?
They've just dwindled. We make up less than 2% of the population of
wow.
the United States when we once made up the entire population of the United States. From the time that we discovered ships on our shores, you know, it's just continued to go down. And, obviously, you know, people marry who they want to marry, you know. I married a white Irish guy, so, and we have not had children, so that, you know, dwindles down the count of Native Americans in this country, and not everyone identifies as a Native American. They might say, oh, I have, like, you know, 1/16th in me or whatever, and I'm like, that doesn't matter, you know, you're still part of our family, so, we make up less than 2% of the population when we once had the whole continent.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the coming of settlers to the East Coast and how that affected Native Americans there before the movement westward.
Well, if you pay attention in history class, you learn about the Puritans mm-hmm. and the Shakers and the Pilgrims and, England sending their people over to Jamestown, and you learn about the infamous Roanoke Colony and, rumors of Native involvement in Roanoke. Of course, we don't know what happened in Roanoke. That actually still fascinates me. But, probably one of the big things is, you know, the Pilgrims coming over, and because they settled in what is now Massachusetts. And actually, I am Oneida, so we were in, like, the New York area, so we would have probably had encounters with, you know, people over there. And you learn about the story of the first Thanksgiving, and everyone sits down and breaks bread, and it's all happy, except they don't tell you about the massacre that happens afterwards. So,
And that massacre was which massacre?
So the true story of Thanksgiving is You know, there was the breaking of bread and mm-hmm. food, but then the settlers, like the Mashpee Wampanoag, which were the tribe that broke bread with the pilgrims, actually suffered their deaths at the hands of the pilgrims. Mm. Yeah, they don't teach that in school. No, everything is all happy and rainbows and not that. Just like you also don't learn about the true story of Pocahontas in school either. But mm-hmm. yeah, so, I mean, it just kept encroaching and settlement kept moving westward. And I know exactly for a fact, after the Oneida helped the Patriots win the revolution, we got booted out. And we were.
So over time, were there not many Native Americans on the East Coast then?
No. Not, it just, they continued to keep sweeping us out and continue moving us out. And, you know, it was with Andrew Jackson and the Indian Removal Act that at mm-hmm. one point there were no natives in the southeastern part of the
United
States.
And that was in about 1814 that Andrew Jackson set up parameters for, is that right?
He negotiated some treaties in 1814. That would have been at the end of the War of 1812. When he was president with the Indian Removal Act, I believe that was 1836, is when you really shoved everything out, and then you had the Trail of Tears.
So in what, let's go back to the Indian Removal Act of, I have 1830, but 1836, whenever it was, but what was the effect of that? They removed them from the East Coast? Or?
They removed them from the southeastern part of the United States. Okay. So it was mainly like the Cherokee and the Chickasaw and the Choctaw and the Seminoles and any tribe that was residing in the southeastern part of the United States.
So how did they move them? They just told them they had to leave?
Well, some tribes signed treaties so they were promised land in what was Indian Territory, which is now present-day Oklahoma, that kind of area. Mm-hmm. So they were given the opportunity to get new lands when they went west, and so some signed treaties. Others, you know, had to be forcibly removed. The Cherokee ended up being forcibly removed, and that's how you got the Trail of Tears.
And could you tell our listeners a little bit about that Trail of Tears? How many died? What was it all?
Thousands died. The Trail of Tears was the forced removal of the Cherokee from the southeast okay. part of the United States. This had been years in the making. The Indian Removal Act was actually signed in 1830, but it wasn't until 1836 is when the Cherokee were finally moved. According to, you know, on the government side of it, they were given time and time again to, you know, get their act together and move. And finally, you just had an encroachment of settlers that were coming in, and we needed the land. The government needed the land. So they corralled the Cherokee that were remaining into basically a stockade. You didn't get to grab any of your belongings. What you had on is what you took with you, and they marched you across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And thousands died from disease, yep. hunger, cold, because you were walking in the elements.
Sure.
Yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah, and the report I read said 4,000, over 4,000 died, and basically no belongings, looting by the soldiers and...
Yeah, looting happened as they were being corralled up to leave their homes.
And when they were corralled, what were they corralled to?
They were like a stockade area, like wherever you would have your horses or your cattle or whatever, is basically where they rounded them all up and got them all ready to leave.
Huh.
Yeah.
You know, we look back at our history and, you know, we have much to be very proud of, but we sure have things to look at that aren't so good.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So by 1840, my understanding is that no tribes lived south, in the south between the Atlantic Ocean and the Mississippi River.
Right. With the exception of maybe the few renegades that hid and didn't leave.
They
yeah.
did. They're always renegades. How did the concept of reservations come about, and how were allotments decided? Did reservations come quite a bit later, or?
So reservations probably started developing around the time of the Indian Removal Act, because you had to take these people that you
right.
were moving, you had to put them somewhere. And so with the development of treaties and, you know, promised lands, we started to place people on reservations. And allotment came... After that, an allotment was actually the breakup of reservations.
Explain for our listeners how allotments worked.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So basically what the government would do is they would take the reservation and they would divide up, they would like just little like, I guess take it lots. And divide it, yeah, divide mm-hmm. it into blocks. And each male head of the male household would get a certain allotment. So that's where your family would live. Mm-hmm. And then whatever was left over after everything had been divided was sold. And it was usually sold to non-native people. Okay. So this once communal land was now broken up. And it was basically a way to assimilate us into a quote-unquote mainstream society.
Right.
And, you know, they wanted us to become farmers and, you know, live how the white settlers live. And that doesn't always work because it's not your custom. That's not your tradition. You know, depending on what tribe you're in, you're not a farmer. You're a right. hunter or, you know, things like that. So, yeah. And so what it just broke up our lands even more.
And you mentioned that for people in poverty, that farming, especially when equipment became involved, was almost an impossible thing.
Well, yeah, because that's expensive.
Yeah.
A lot of a farmer's wealth is tied up in his equipment and all of that. But if you don't have the money to buy the equipment, how are you supposed to farm? How are you supposed to feed your family? And not to mention that in Indian territory, the land that they were given was usually the poorest land possible.
Mm-hmm.
So farming wouldn't have even been possible until it was mechanized later on.
Amazing. How did reservations overall, I mean, it seems like there was an ebb and flow of reservations, but how did it work out for the Native American to be on reservations? Was there any advantage? What were the downsides?
I think if there was an advantage, the one advantage would be is that you were together. You okay. were, you know, with your people. It was sure. still that sense of community. The disadvantage, there were plenty. You lost the land that was yours. Like, you once were roaming free, you know, being part of the earth, and now you're basically stuck in a concentration camp, and mm-hmm. that, you know, and you're dependent upon others for supplies and for food because you might be farming, but the land is horrible, so you can't always farm, so you have to depend on those traders that come through so you can trade for goods and, you know, food. And you might have been able to go out and once hunt the bison or the deer, but now you're confined to the reservation and you can't leave. It also helped strip away the sense of who we are and the sense of our culture, because as you're there, you're surrounded by, you know, the soldiers, and they're constantly watching you, and, you know, you lose your sense of who you are. You might lose your sense of your language.
We often hear there was a high rate of alcoholism and drug use but especially alcoholism on the reservations. Do you think that was a side effect of just being confined?
I think it was probably twofold. I think one was the introduction of alcohol into our diets. It was something that we didn't have before. And it was easy to go ahead and, you know, quote, get that person drunk and then get them to sign, a treaty or something. But then on the second, you know, these once brave warriors can't be the warriors anymore. They can't go out and do what they are meant to do. And so you've got this easy substance sitting there.
Yeah.
And you drink it.
Listening to all of this, Diane, does it make you think about, I mean, our country and some of the things we're doing or the mistakes that we've made in history?
Yeah, I think when I listen to people talk about history, mm-hmm. most of us were exposed to something written from a very white perspective, and kind of the history of manifest destiny, that we always had the right to go and do, and we were more civilized, therefore we could impose our will, and making people property, you know, whether it was, American, Native, Indians, mm-hmm. that could be just moved because it was more convenient.
Yeah.
Property, you know, the economy of dehumanizing people so you can enslave them and sell their children as property. Just, you know, the way our country has done some ugly things that I think we as white people in particular like to gloss over. And that might be part of our common convenient memories in terms of not wanting to remember some of the painful things, because it then leads us to what are some advantages that we have because of this long sordid history of oppression and racism, you know, that has been directed at different people. So,
absolutely.
You know, for me, that's why I was so excited that Heather would come and visit us again, because she helps to lead us into understanding on a very human level some of the atrocities that have been perpetrated and that really lead us into today of where it's justifying current government policy, which is, you know, again, dehumanizing and using racist policies.
And sometimes along the way, people really justify it. Like, Heather, you've mentioned a lot of times, like, trying to Americanize people or get... We go to Arizona every winter for a month or two, and I went to the Heard Museum, and that's the first place where I ever realized that they have a lot of displays about the children being taken from Native American families and what they, you know, what they thought they were doing was good, Americanizing them so they could better assimilate in the country. Tell us a little bit about that history. It was so sad to read some of those stories. One little 7-year-old girl tried to walk back to her family in the winter and died.
Yeah, it's, I usually say when I give a presentation or a lecture, and I know I said it today at the Civil War Museum, I try to make a joke every now and then because Native history is so depressing. And the taking of children from their homes is probably one of the most depressing that can happen. There is actually a photo online, you can go and find it. And it's there's a boarding school in the background, and in the front is a little set of teepees, and there's some Lakota gathered outside, and it was parents who didn't want to be separated from their children. So it's sad, and I don't even know where to start.
I think in time some of the boarding schools did help with language and various things, but it never justifies taking those children away from their families. And, you know, they said they'll get American haircuts and American clothes. And, you know, it's just, it was really, really sad to read those stories and think that some people thought this was the right thing to do, you know. You talked about a lone wolf versus Hitchcock. It was a famous case that went to the Supreme Court. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yes. It was during the Allotment Act. And what basically the lone wolf was a Kiowa chief, and he noticed that the government was trying to sell land that had been promised to the Kiowas, the Comanches, and there was one other tribe, and it escapes me at the moment. But nothing could be sold without 3/4 approval from the tribe. So 3/4 of them had to agree, and then things could be sold.
So,
well, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. And the government was like, well, no, we can sell them anyways. And so Lone Wolf took his case all the way to the Supreme Court. He filed a grievance on behalf of the Kiowa and the Comanche. And he was like, no, you can't do this. This is what the treaty says. It says it has to be 3/4. And you don't have that vote, so you cannot sell this land. You cannot remove us from it. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court basically said, no, Congress can basically null and void anything.
Break a treaty. Yeah.
Anytime they want. And who are you to tell us that we can't? And it was really the first time that the inferiority of the first peoples here in this country was put on paper.
It's interesting, too, that the first people who were here did not receive citizenship until when?
1924.
All that time.
My grandfather was 13 years old when he became a citizen of the United States.
And when they were made citizens in, when Native Americans were made citizens in 1924, were the women also made citizens? Or?
Yes. No, the women were. But you could receive your citizenship in other ways. Like if you were a woman and you married a non-Native person, like you married a white settler, you became a citizen. Or you got it through military service because beyond everything, I mean, Native Americans served in the military. We serve at a higher rate than any other group. Mm-hmm. So you could get your citizenship that way, too.
But now, even though citizenship was granted in 24, they didn't vote right away, right?
No, you couldn't vote right away.
Hmm. So I think, how long was it before they could vote? Maybe like 48 or something like that. It was a long time.
It was a really long time. So my grandfather was became a citizen when he was 13, and then he couldn't vote until he was almost in his 30s, I think. But, you know, that's okay. I mean, what do you say to that? Yeah. I don't know what to say to that other than, oh, my gosh.
So there was in 34, maybe you mentioned this already, the Indian Reorganization Act, and it ended allotment.
It did. Was that a good thing? The Indian Reorganization Act was also called, like, the Indian New Deal.
Okay.
Roosevelt, FDR particularly, was in office. And so we were, as a country, we were going through a bunch of things. But it ended the policy of allotment. But by the time it ended allotment had already done so much.
Yeah.
So any land that had not been sold, it reverted back to the tribe, which was great. But you still had so much land that was already sold, so these reservations started to look like checkerboards. And it still broke up the reservations. It still broke up the land. I like to equate the Oneida Reservation in Green Bay. It's all checkerboarded. And so, like, this block might be reservation, but you go two blocks down, and that's not reservation. Yeah. So it's very interesting. Yeah.
But that affected Menominees in Milwaukee, right, because their land hadn't been sold so much?
Well, the Menominee Reservation, as you see it today, was not affected by allotment. They were able to hold on to it particularly. But, I mean, that's the reservation that they have today. Historically, Menominees had a lot more land. They had over 10 million acres at one point. I mean, basically all of the UP and like half of Wisconsin. And now they're down to like 240,000 acres.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a little ridiculous.
And then in 53, there was a termination policy.
Oh my gosh.
64 to 109 tribes. How did the tribes just get terminated?
That is such a complicated answer. I will try to nutshell it down, but basically there was a senator out of Utah who decided that he was on the Indian Affairs Committee, first of all, and he decided that there were tribes in the country that were successful, meaning that they had found a niche or a business that was working for them. In this particular case with the Menominee, it was lumber. The Menominee had and still do have a successful lumber business. And they were able to pay for a lot of things. In fact, the Menominee actually paid the salary of their Indian agent. So they didn't need to take, you know, that, you know, money from the government. However, the senator out of Utah, Senator Watkins, actually was like, you know, they're successful enough that they don't need us anymore. They don't need our help. Because you did receive government funding for different things, for hospitals, for schools, for things like that, usually stuff that was promised in treaties anyway. And so he decided to come up with the policy of termination. And that basically meant stripping you of your federally recognized tribal status.
Wow.
So you were just like everyone else. Now, there's nothing wrong with being just like everyone else, except for the fact that you have treaties that are promises that you're supposed to follow. And the Menominee weren't the only tribes, you know, terminated, but it actually, the Menominee basically went from being one of the most successful tribes to falling flat on their faces right away.
Wow.
And
it's part of losing identity and cultures, was it?
Absolutely,
not?
Absolutely. I try to think about, like, if somebody came to me and looked at me and told me I was no longer Oneida. I'd be like, wait, what? No. That's right. Who I am. Mm-hmm. But just as the Menominee are, we are resilient and we rise again.
Well, I think a few better things happened. Maybe like in 68, there was an Indian civil rights law. Was that a good thing? And a self-determination act under Ford?
Those were things, yes, that tried to turn the tide into more positive for us. The Indian Civil Rights Act guaranteed that we were guaranteed the rights in the Bill of Rights. And whether we were on reservation or off reservation, our rights were enforced. It kind of tried to help protect from corruption or violation of your civil liberties. Self-determination basically overturned termination and helped give us self-determination over our education, over our economic status, over our tribal governments. So, yeah.
And then the UN voted on the rights of indigent people. How did that affect things?
That was huge. It let us know that the world was watching.
Uh-huh.
Though it's always important when the world is watching.
Yep. And the really hopeful thing out of all of this is that there's probably been an increase in activism, and in the 70s and 80s, maybe it would be good for your listeners to hear a little bit about AIM and what AIM attempts to do, and just the movement toward trying to make change, trying to rebel against what isn't right, but to get your own rights.
Right, absolutely. So AIM stands for the American Indian Movement, and that name was actually given on purpose so the letters would form the word AIM. There was one goal we were looking for. We were aiming towards something. We were aiming to be recognized as people. We were aiming for our treaty rights to be enforced and recognized. We were... It was about recognition and allowing us to actually just be. We were here. We don't want anything more. We don't want anything less. We want what we were told we were going to get. And we deserve it. I mean, this shouldn't matter your race, the color of your skin. It's ours. This land is ours. And, you know, in 68, you have the midst of the civil rights movement going on. And, you know, you've got people that are coming together. So whether it was the American Indian Movement, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Panther Movement, second wave feminism, everyone's coming together, LGBT movement, everyone's coming together, and we're fighting for one main cause, and that's to be recognized. And I really don't think that's too much to ask.
Education is a huge part of it, is it not? You had tribal colleges, or you have?
Tribal colleges. I believe there's 36 or 38 federally recognized tribal colleges. And there, one here in the state of Wisconsin is College of the Menominee Nation. Mm-hmm. And it's a great college. You can earn 2 and 4 year degrees there. It can prepare you to go on to schools like UW or any other school in the country. But education is key. And education was also stressed in the AIM movement. You know, they needed lawyers, they needed teachers. So we went out and we got our education, and we came back and we brought those skills to the to the movement.
And that whole holding on to activism and recognizing its importance, and that's really important today, Diane, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that activism today, and you know, we're being challenged by current national policies as well as state and local, and people are exploring ways to really support each other more and to be more aware of what the history is and ways that privileges have advantaged some of us, and that really we're not going to have our true humanity unless we grant the same humanity to everyone else.
Absolutely.
So I think that. So I have a little reading if you would like me to finish, or
you know,
should I save that for a little bit?
Yes, let's save that just for the very end.
Okay.
That is great. You know, I was surprised, Heather, at some of the acts were passed specifically for Native Americans, like the Indian Child Welfare Act. That was all 78, I think, American Indian Religious Freedom Act. It's said that things, I think, were finally turning. There was some recognition. Do you think that was helpful?
I think so, definitely. I think it finally got to the point when people come together and they make their voices heard. It takes a long, long time, but you can start to get things done. With the Indian Child Welfare Act, we were tired of taking our kids from our homes.
Yes.
Like, for sometimes literally no reason. Mm-hmm. Were there instances where children needed to be taken and put in care, in better care? Absolutely, but I am not... here to judge that. I'm sure there were instances where it wasn't a good home environment, but I'm also pretty positive that a majority of the time the environment was just fine. We were like, no, you're done taking our kids. You've been taking them for hundreds of years by now. Mm-hmm. It's over. The Indian Religious Freedom Act, we wanted to just be able to practice our religion like all of our other Christian and Muslim and Jewish brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to practice our religion. Mm-hmm. And that was it. The government was finally like, yeah, you should be able to do that. So with that, we could do Sundance again. We could do Ghost Dance. Not that these things weren't happening regardless, but now we could do it in the open and we didn't have to hide it.
Yes.
There are objects in nature that are sacred to us and we couldn't have access to them, and now we can. So, it's absolutely brilliant.
I was going to ask you about that, too. The environment has seemed like it's been so important all along to Native Americans. My daughter had this poster up forever. We do not inherit the land from our ancestors.
We borrow it from our children.
Why do you think that is, that the environment has been so important to Native Americans?
She gives us the nourishment that we need. She gives us the safe havens that we need. She gives us everything that we need. She's our mother.
Mm-hmm.
She gives us everything that we need to survive.
That's well said.
Why wouldn't we take care of her?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's a good question for many of our leaders today.
Well, yes. Why should we take care of her? Many of what we are still fighting for in the Indigenous community.
Right. I know you do a presentation. Oh, I was surprised at the beginning when you said Jefferson, because I know you do a whole presentation on Jefferson and Adams, so I've got to find that one and watch it sometime. But you do one on the power of Native women. What is that about, and why is the role of Native women so important? And maybe you better throw in Pocahontas, since you mentioned her, and now everybody wants to know the real story.
Well, for those waiting, I am going to put together a talk just on her. But the women are the cornerstones of our society. It doesn't matter whether it is Native culture or non-Native culture. We are the caretakers. We, have the babies. I don't. You do. But I don't. We take care of the home. And yes, the men go out and they hunt and they do all that. But then what happens afterwards? We, tan the hides. We do all of this. We make sure there's food in everyone's belly and that everyone is taken care of. And not just that, but in today, in the 21st century, we're leading the movement for so many things.
Yeah.
And so when I put together the talk on the power of Native women, I picked about 14 really, really awesome, amazing people, from Pocahontas, who was a survivor of, for lack of a better term, a survivor of child rape and kidnapping, and how she fought back, to Buffalo Calf Road woman who gave Custer the blow that knocked him off his horse at Little Bighorn, to women who were doctors and would work, went to medical school and came back to their reservations because there wasn't doctors on their reservations, to amazing women today who led the fight for restoration for the Menominee, such as Ada Deer, who I had the privilege of talking to last year. She is so awesome, to women like Winona LaDuke, who are continuously fighting for our earth. Honor the Earth is Winona LaDuke's organization. And she, is continuously fighting for clean water. And, all those water protectors out mm-hmm. there were women. There right. were men, too, but women were leading the fight. And so...
Yeah. Just actually, on the way driving here, I heard that the women in Congress... tend to be produce more action items.
I believe that 100%.
Mm-hmm. We're doers. We come up through helping the schools out and
getting involved. We see a problem and we're like, okay, we have to fix
right.
that.
Right.
Yeah.
I think there's enough time for this question yet, but I was very interested that Native Americans played a really important role in the Underground Railroad, although Native Americans were also enslaved sometimes. Do you want to just touch on that for our listeners?
Right, and then and in some cases they were also slaveholders as well. So I don't like to sugarcoat my history. It's all, but yeah, there were some groups of Native Americans, particularly in the eastern part of the United States, southeastern part of the United States. So whether that be the Seminoles were a big one, where they would harbor fugitive slaves if they went south.
Okay.
And they would take them in, and so you had, there's a mixture between the Seminole population and what was the slave population down there, and there was intermarriage, but if you went, because Florida was where the Seminoles were, was Spanish, was a part of the United States. So if you could escape there, the Seminoles would keep you. They would harbor you. They would say, yeah, you can stay here. If you went north, there were tribes in the New England area that would help out as well. But also happening in the South, just like in the United, just like in regular United States, they were also slaveholders. So they the Cherokee were big at slaveholders, and actually, even some of those Cherokees that had to leave on the Trail of Tears, you know, left behind huge plantations with huge slave populations. Sometimes their slaves went with them, so it was all very, you know, it was very, it was a strange relationship, an interesting relationship, but a strange one.
Well, Heather, I think there's time in just a minute. If you'd like to give a message to our listeners, maybe why you do this, what you would like them to know about Native Americans in a minute or so.
Yeah, why do I do this? I do this because there is there's an entire chapter of history that we miss, that we forget about. And like Diane said earlier, we like to sugarcoat things. I don't like to sugarcoat things. It might not be pleasant. It might not be happy. But how do you learn if you're only learning the good parts? And I don't want people to think that I am in some way, shape, or form a, quote, bad American or unpatriotic. I'm glad I live in a country that I can do this and that I can call us out on it and say, you know what, we're not the greatest nation in the world. We can be. We absolutely can be, but we have to recognize our flaws. We have to recognize that we held people in bondage. We have to recognize that we pushed people off their land. We have to recognize that, you know, we there's not really a freedom of religion when our Muslim brothers and sisters can't practice their what their religion is. We have to recognize those things. Once we recognize those things, once we correct them, then we can be great.
That is beautifully said, Heather. Thank you so much. And we're going to end with Diane has a reading to share, and I don't know if you want to say something about it first.
Yes. I wanted to share this just because this is, I think, especially to my white brothers and sisters that are out in the audience. As we're dealing with our own feelings and realities and we're being open to new relationships and new growth, and sometimes we're just too busy or we're just too much into individualistic sort of solutions, or that we're somehow a little more exceptional. I love the way the Native Americans have taught us to, like, just be a part of something whole and that the earth will provide and that we can help each other to do that. So this is called Earth, Teach Me to Remember. Earth, teach me stillness as the grasses are stilled with light. Earth, teach me suffering as old stones suffer with memory. Earth, teach me humility as blossoms are humble with beginning. Earth, teach me caring as the mother who secures her young. Earth, teach me courage as the tree which stands alone. Earth, teach me limitation as the ant which crawls on the ground. Earth, teach me freedom as the eagle which soars in the sky. Earth, teach me resignation as the leaves which fall and die in the fall. Earth, teach me regeneration as the seed which rises in the spring. Earth, teach me to forget myself as melted snow forgets its life. Earth, teach me to remember kindness as dry fields weep in the rain. and that's from the Ute North American people.
So beautifully, thank you for that. Beautifully read. Thank you so much. And so I would like to thank our guest today, historian and speaker Heather Beagle, and community activist and civil servant Diane Lang, for sharing with our listeners your passion for the things that matter and for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And finally, thanks to you, our listeners, for sharing with us your time this Saturday morning. I'm Linda Fleshensky, and I hope that you will join us here at WGTD every Saturday morning for this program as we explore the important subjects that touch our communities, because as we all know so well, community matters. Take care.